I know I had to get caught in order to save my life, because the one problem with escorting and being bipolar is you don't have a ceiling to what you're going to do.
It's How to Be Amazing, brought to you by PRX. I'm Michael Ian Black. There is a question that I get a lot regarding this podcast. And the question I get is, Michael, what makes a person amazing? And, you know, it's not an easy question to answer because there are so many people doing so many amazing things in all kinds of varied fields and various endeavors and all kinds of things. And sometimes some of those amazing things are not at all what you would expect. My guest today fits the bill in at least three different ways. First of all, after a wildly successful collegiate track career, Susie Favor Hamilton ran in three different Olympic Games. Second, and I'm not just being salacious here, while a wife and mother, she became, according to her, the number two high-priced escort in Las Vegas. And finally, and this is the part about Susie that I find most amazing, actually, is that she speaks about all of it with such remarkable candor, grace, and wit. Her new memoir, Fast Girl, tells her story. Susie Favor Hamilton, welcome to How to Be Amazing.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate being on your show.
I'm so happy that you're here. I mean, your story really is remarkable for all the reasons that I just said. And the thing that really struck me reading your book, there's so much just it's so cinematic in a certain way, and it's very tactile. There's a lot to sort of grab onto as you're reading. But what really struck me more than anything was how much loss there is in your story. It feels so much to me like a story of loss. Not only you've lost a couple people in your life that you love very much. I think every athlete goes through a loss of their sort of athletic life. There's losses in races. And then eventually there's even a literal loss of identity as you go from Susie to your nom de, amour, Kelly. And there's also a loss of, control?
Yeah, definitely. Except I felt I got that back when I became an escort, which is just how I felt.
What was the nature of the control that you were looking for in that part of your life?
I think, for me, growing up and being so coachable and finding running at such an early age and in fifth grade and beating all the boys, I also found that gave me power, but the coaches had this power over me to tell me what to do all the time, and I listened, and, I never spoke up if something was too difficult. I just did it.
At this point in your life, though, you're very much in control, not only of your own athletic self, but also just in the highly regimented training schedule, right?
Right.
So what's
I'm disciplined to do this every day.
So how do you distinguish between sort of being disciplined and being in control?
I guess disciplined was almost, I was told I have to be number one, so you have to train every day. So I guess that didn't make me in control. The coach was in control. The society was in control because they wanted me to win so much. I thought in my mind that everybody wanted me to win, my community, my state. I was kind of the sweetheart to Wisconsin, the darling, the perfect girl. So I felt I had to do this. I had to win. And that was the part that I didn't have any control over. I just had to train, train, train. I couldn't lose. I didn't have permission to lose.
And was that...
Does that make sense?
It does. Was the permission that you... Was it
permission?
Did you have to give yourself permission and you weren't able to? I mean, were those exterior factors real? Or were they self-conjured?
They were self-conjured, definitely. This is what I perceived. And I didn't have a voice to speak up, where most people are going to speak up and say, I'm really tired. I'm beat up from yesterday's workout. Is there any way we can monitor this workout? I never spoke up. I just did. That's why coaches loved me, because I was so coachable. I never caused any problems with the coach. I just did what they said. And so much of my life, you know, my father, I did what he said because I wanted to please him so badly. I wanted to be the perfect daughter for my father. And he adored me. I was the perfect little girl growing up into college. I mean, high school, college. You know, I felt I could do no wrong, which is so ironic how perfect I was. But I look back at that perfect person. It's almost like the child actor who takes on a role and becomes that role, or society thinks that they're that role every day.
In your book, you talk a lot about how that perfect girl came to be as a result of family tension and mental illness, particularly with your brother, Dan. Did you feel like if you could just be perfect, it would solve everybody else's problems?
I did. I felt like I started to see winning races, that, you know, my parents would come to these races, and I started to see that, oh, I made them so happy, where my brother's behavior, so erratic and up and down, because of his bipolar, he would be, you know, high as a kite or really low, and I couldn't understand his behavior. I knew nothing about bipolar. I just thought, my brother is crazy. He had no control over his mind. His mind was in control, and his mind had a disease. So looking back, his behavior, I get it. I understand it. I wish I could have had that compassion then that I do now.
What was his erratic behavior like? How did that manifest itself?
He would hear voices in his head. He would be delusional. And I know for him to try and quiet the mind was alcohol. So alcohol became his vice. And when he was drinking, that really exacerbated the mania. And what happened was, I remember a couple times there were instances with guns in our house. Growing up in Wisconsin, hunting was very normal. And so we had shotguns in the house. And as kids, we knew not to touch the guns. But one particular time I write about in the book is where my brother had a shotgun to his head. And my cousin was there saying his name, and he wouldn't respond. And my father had to run down, grab the gun out of his hand. But there were suicide attempts in his life growing up that I saw. And that's very difficult for anybody to have to witness, and not being able to talk about it. So all of this just
What do you mean, not being able to talk about it?
You know, I grew up in a small town in central Wisconsin called Stevens Point, and everybody knew about who you were. Everybody knew my family. I was the great runner. We looked like the Brady Bunch, and that's how a lot of families looked, unless somebody was divorced. And God forbid that divorce back then was looked upon as just awful.
And this is in the 80s, right, roughly?
Yeah, I grew up in, I was born in 1968, so I'm 47 now, and things just weren't talked about. And so I don't blame my parents. I kind of, in some ways, it was society forcing you to be perfect. And, you know, you would hang the pictures in your house of everybody smiling and looking perfect, when in reality, it's the opposite. But that's how it had to look back then.
Were you conscious of this role you were playing, or had you just sort of so fully invested in it that you didn't even know yourself?
That's a great question, because I really do think I was so fully invested. I was so consumed in it that this was the only way, that I wasn't conscious truly that I was doing this. This is all I knew, is be a certain way. And, you know, I couldn't imagine being a rebel and doing something like partying and drinking and getting out of control and doing drugs or having sex.
Is this common among elite athletes, this
perfect image?
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's the type A personality, get straight A's, I mean, just to a T, perfect. And they don't want anybody to know their faults. And I see this on Twitter. Looking at people, runners that I follow, you know, they always show the perfect picture of them, and life is so great. And, you know, never write about tribulations. It's always create the perfect image because our fans want to see the perfect image. In reality, nobody is perfect. But in runners, especially, there really isn't the bad guy, the rebel. I've started to see it in one particular athlete who is trying to fight against being perfect, but then in reality, he knows he's going to lose his followers if he does. In my case, I've had a few runners really step up to the plate, but they won't ever, they'll favorite things, but they'll never retweet because then they're associated with me and that will hurt their fan base, will write back, "I can't believe you support the whore." Or, you know, these are the people that don't understand in particular that would say something like that. But I'm not safe to retweet.
So has the running community largely turned against you?
I wouldn't say largely. I would say there's quite a few that feel I owe them an apology.
For what?
For some people. For damaging the sport and, you know, in their mind, being the slut, being the whore, being the sex worker, I have hurt the running community. And, you know, they won't focus on the illness. They see this as such a negative. And when in reality, so many runners are compulsive, obsessive, they have this drive that is not normal to train as hard as they do. There's a lot of chemical imbalance in athletes in general. But again, keep that perfect image and, you know, then you get more people to support you. And I also believe because track and field is a sport where it is limited to the amount of fans that you have, they don't want to disrupt any of that.
Look at this performance by Susie Favor coming down the home stretch, high knee lift. Look at the arm action. Training in the winter in Stevens Point must be difficult, but it has reaped her wonderful rewards.
Are there gender differences in this? I mean, is it harder for women than men? Do men have more leeway in this world?
You mean in track and field?
Yeah, or I guess in elite athletics in general.
I would, you know, that's a hard one. I think in track and field, it's easier for women to get publicity because maybe they like to look at the pretty face. Or I know when I was running, I always got commented on my body. You know, people would watch me race because they wanted to look at my body. So, you know, in men,
wait, and people would say that to you? People would have those kinds of comments? Like, you look hot out there, Susie? Like that kind of thing?
Yes, yes, exactly. And I, you know,
I mean, I might think that, but I'm not going to say it to you.
Right. And I heard comments. And then also I had this reinforced to me in college. I had a woman who wrote a letter to my coach. My coach called me into his office and told me he got this letter. And the letter stated from this woman who we didn't know, she stated that I should wear two bras when I run because my boobs are bouncing too much. I was humiliated. Here, my body doesn't look like I'm supposed to, I thought. So I wore two sports bras. Mm. Then after my first Olympics in 92, well, let's go back. In college, another thing happened where a male coach on the men's team was filming my breasts while I was running. And I found that out from one of the athletes who was
just
there.
Just voyeuristically?
Yeah. And, you know, some people, I have no idea, but some people might take it as a compliment. I did not see that as a compliment in any way. You know, maybe some women think, oh, that's cool, he admires my body. I did not have that
reaction. Yeah, I have a hard time thinking about any of the women I know being like, oh, that's cool, he's videotaping.
Yeah, same here. Exactly. Same here. Maybe a woman who wants attention, but yeah, I find it hard to believe also. That was another reminder, Susie, you aren't perfect. You're supposed to be perfect, and now you don't look the part. And I don't want people to think of me in a sexual way. So after my first Olympics, I basically had a breast reduction. I'm like, I have to get rid of my boobs because this is not the look. A look of a runner is flat-chested. And after I woke up from the surgery and they took the bandages off, my first reaction was, oh my God, they didn't take enough out.
One of the topics that comes up a couple times in regarding your running career are performance-enhancing drugs and your adamant refusal to take them. And that, listening to you now, it feels incongruous. It feels like you almost should have, because you were so determined to win. Why didn't you?
I grew up, again, in a Midwestern family, being perfect. Drugs, and this is, again, ironic, drugs were morally, you did not do that. And my morals were really good. You know, I didn't believe in having sex. I didn't believe in taking drugs. So, no, it wasn't an option. It never crossed my mind till later in my career where I was approached to do drugs.
You started dating your husband in college.
Freshman year.
What was your physical relationship like with him?
I was scared to death to have sex with him. I met him, and then for 2 months, the first 2 months, I would not even go there. That was so not an option. And, you know, like any guy, he would, you know, approach the subject in a very delicate way. And, you know, we'd have the discussion. It wouldn't just happen.
I'm not sure every guy approaches it in a delicate way.
That's true. No, yeah, you're absolutely right. He approached it in a delicate way and would say, you know, would you like to do this? And would you like to have sex? And I'd be like, no, I'm going to get pregnant.
Were you a virgin?
If I have sex. Yes, I was. And he was my only partner for 20 years. Mm. But after 2 months, it was his birthday. He got a hotel room. He thought this would be the perfect time that I would have sex with him. And I said, no, I can't do it. But ironically, the next day in his dorm room, I had been thinking about it. And I said, yeah, I'm ready to do it. But we have to make sure, like, we get, you know, wear a condom, get spermicide, do everything if we're going to do this, because right. I can't get pregnant. That would blow everything.
When you and your husband, on your 20th wedding anniversary, you engage in a threesome. It was your idea. And afterwards, right. You say, you know, something changed for me. It was like, you know, a light switch went off. Was it the same for you when you first had sex? Did something change for you there?
Yes, I felt I didn't quite feel like the little girl. And I think that's important that I forgot to say is my whole life I felt like the little girl. I was always the little sister. I was always the little girl in my parents' mind. So having sex for the first time, I felt like, okay, I'm no longer the little girl on the inside, but I'll still portray that on the outside, that I am the little girl, but this will be my little secret with Mark. And we began to explore sex in different ways. Once we had sex for the first time, I wasn't afraid to explore and learn more. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is fun. And in college, I mean, you're having sex every day, at least we were.
you were, I was not.
Yeah. And exploring and just taking things to another level, and because it brought you even closer.
When did the Olympics become a reality for you?
That became a reality early on in 84. I was in high school and I was running the fastest time in high school in the country. And the junior nationals that year were being held at the Olympic trials. So we were told, you guys, you juniors are the next Olympians. That's why we're letting you run at the Olympic trials. We didn't run against the Olympians. We ran in our own separate race. But that was a pivotal moment where, okay, maybe I could be an Olympian. But I also struggled with the fact that maybe I wasn't good enough. But that was kind of the first inkling that I was potentially the next person to come up to get to that level.
maybe this is a totally stupid question, but because
there is not a stupid question with me.
Okay, well, it is with me because I sometimes feel like an idiot for asking what I think are obvious questions, but I don't know because I've never been an elite athlete or even a very good athlete. So, you know, when you're an elite athlete and you're sort of traveling all over the world and competing in these prestigious events, does the Olympics still retain the kind of luster and mystique that those of us who are not involved in athletics see it as? Or does it become kind of just another step on a journey?
No, that is the icing on the cake. When you've become an Olympian, you have succeeded. But yet, once you become an Olympian, then all of a sudden you need to be a medalist. Going to the Olympics isn't good enough in a lot of athletes' minds. But the thing is with track and field is, honestly, most people don't care about track and field until every Olympics 4 years later.
Right.
So the track world has its own little small group that follows, but they shine as the athlete every 4 years in the Olympics. So it's even magnified even more because you have this one opportunity in front of the world to show your stuff, basically, how good you are.
And your main event is the 1500 meter race, right?
Right. And so 100 yards short of a mile, basically almost four laps around the track, running at 64 seconds a lap. And just brutally painful. What it goes in training for that, you have to be able to push yourself into the state of enormous pain where your body is gripped with a lactic acid and every step becomes tougher and tougher, but yet you have to fight through that in order to be a champion in running. You have to love pain to some extent, otherwise forget it. Don't go into that sport.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, the idea of loving pain. Did you love pain? Do you love pain?
I loved pain because of the high. The more pain I feel in exercise, the bigger the high. Lately, I've been sprinting once a week along the ocean in the dark. And when I get to the point where I've reached the pier and I've sprinted maybe a mile, I feel like I'm going to throw up because my body isn't used to doing this.
That's so funny. That's I can hear the joy in your voice as you're talking about almost throwing up. And I'm just sitting here recoiling at the idea of running that hard.
I know. And I have such a high from that. And I'll even race. The other day, I don't know what got into me. I was starting the high and I feel it kick in when I'm running. I'm like, oop, there it is. Loving it. So it will actually kick in and flow through my veins. And I'm running and I run by this guy. I never would have done this in my life. I run by this guy and I'm about to pass him, but I see he's an athlete. I can tell by the way he looks and his physique. And I take
my hand.
So
he looks like me, in other words. I got it. I understand.
Absolutely, because I know what you look like. So I take my arm and I wave him on to come with me. And so he starts following me and I'm like, okay, let's start racing. I'm going to pick up the pace because he knows obviously I want him to run with me.
Right.
And so he's, you know, I know he's thinking, oh, I can't let this woman beat me. So we stay together and we end up racing a mile. And that was a pure joy to me. And again, I was going to throw up, but I didn't let on to him. At the end, we stopped, we shook hands and end of story. But and then I turned around and I'm like dry heaving.
Well, you talk about how your kick at the end of races was always your strength, that you at the last 100 yards or so, you could always outkick your opponent. And was that just your capacity to endure pain? Is that all a kick is?
Kick is genetic. So you're born with it. You can fine tune it. But I was always told at a young age, now if anybody is next to you with 200 meters to go, you can outkick them. Nobody has proven to outkick you. It was only in my professional world where drugs could outkick me. And drugs were, oh my God, if you could only experience running against somebody on drugs, powerful steroids or whatever they were doing, it was like running against a machine or somebody bionic. The way they could just pass you so easily and maintain their form, not breathing heavy, where you're just struggling to get to that finish. It was just a bizarre feeling to know I was running against a machine, and not a human being.
All three of your Olympics ended in disappointment for you. You never did medal. Did you feel...
Sometimes people think I got the gold and I just go with it.
Of course.
Yeah.
You must have been aware at the time that you could not compete against women who were taking these drugs. What percentage do you feel like of elite athletes at that time, and maybe even today, are cheating?
In the top level, you know, we're talking like Olympic level, humongous amount of people. It's bigger than you think, because times that are being run aren't humanly possible. And people don't want to know that their heroes are taking drugs, that, and athletes will deny it when they're caught, because I'm too perfect, I would never do that. What do you think people are going to do when they, you know, I'm always baffled by this. When somebody does drugs, are they going to admit to it? Of course, everybody is going to deny it.
In retrospect, do you wish you had done them?
That's a great question, because for my health, obviously not. It wouldn't be worth it. Now that I'm done with my career, I see how small running really is to your life. But at the time, it's huge. You know, it's a hard question to be asked, because everybody else was doing it. Why can't everybody just be clean so we can all be on an even playing field? But you know what? When there's money involved, and, you know, there would be maybe in some big races, it could be $50,000 to win that race.
Well, not to mention all the endorsements, which I imagine is where athletes generate most of their income.
Absolutely. And, you know, I was already doing a lot of endorsements, and I wasn't even winning gold medals. Right. So I had a lot of resentment by other fellow women runners, because why is she getting all this attention?
Well, if they could see that videotape of your boobs going along, they would understand.
Exactly. Exactly. It's funny that when I did basically cut my boobs off, nobody said anything yet. I mean, you could tell.
Your final Olympic event ended with you collapsed on the track. And, you know, you talk about it being a purposeful collapse, because you just, well, why?
So with 200 meters to go in that race, well, first of all, at the starting line, that's the last place I wanted to be. Did not want to be there. Not a great way to go into a race. I just wanted it over. I wanted to vanish. With 200 meters to go, I could feel these runners. I could feel them breathing behind me. And I knew at that moment, there was no way I was going to win. And so a panic attack actually happened, a real live panic attack. I'm seeing white spots, and my legs are feeling like cement blocks. Each lift was incredibly difficult. Somehow, from that a panic attack at 200 meters, I made it another 100 meters, which to this day, I can't believe how I did that. And then with 100 meters to go, one runner passes me, and now in my brain, I'm like, silver medal. It's still okay. Just hold on. And then another girl, and then I'm thinking, bronze. If I do bronze, Nike is still going to, they'll be happy because I'm the only American to ever medal in this event, ever. And then these other girls whiz right by me, and the dream was gone. It was like my life was ruined at that moment. Everybody in the world, including you, was watching me that day. That's what my brain was thinking. And so for a split second, and then it happened. It was so quick. You couldn't even click your fingers with how quick it was. And I fell to the ground, and I remember feeling the track surface beneath me distinctively.
Into the home straightaway, and Suzy Faber-Hamilton has fallen down.
Under the pitiless gaze of the television cameras, Suzy Faber-Hamilton collapses, tumbling onto the red turf.
And so I got up, because I knew in my mind, I have to at least say I'm a three-time Olympic runner, and I finished the race. And when I finished, the media was all around in the tunnel. And I knew they were going to be like, oh my God, what happened to her? She just blew it. She's a mental case. So I passed out. on purpose. Again, I just let my body go. And they brought a wheelchair, and they really thought something was terribly wrong with me when they took me back to the medical room. I was in there for 2 hours. I would not open my eyes for 2 hours. Mm-hmm. I was in such a state of shock and embarrassment that they even did like the heart chest. They thought maybe I was having a heart attack because my breathing was so out of control. This panic attack was continuing on. I did this to myself. Nobody did this. It was my mind that did this. It was the worst moment of my life. And at that time, this was even worse than losing my brother to a suicide, because that's how out of perspective my mind was. And obviously losing my brother was one of the worst moments of my life, along with my best friend, Mary.
Mary had cancer. Your brother, as you said, committed suicide.
Right.
And when Mary died, you were in training, right?
Yes. I actually missed her wedding because I had to run in Switzerland at one of the biggest meets, where actually that was where a certain meat promoter came up to me and told me that I needed to do drugs.
Right.
I could help change this sport that not many people cared about, but only cared about during the Olympics. Mary was always so supportive of me. Even though I missed her wedding, she was like, no worries, Susie. You have to go and train. You have to do this. And that was added pressure when I was at Sydney, the 2000 Olympics, because I felt I also had to win for her.
So your running career comes to an end. You haven't been enjoying running. And right. You struggle a bit trying to, I guess, find your place in the world.
Yeah, you know, I had a baby, my baby girl, which was the best day of my life, was giving birth. I loved it so much. I wanted to do it every day, but I had an epidural.
Sure, you loved that it pain. Was, oh, yeah, the epidural.
Yeah, and I loved there still was pain with it, but, such an amazing day, and having my daughter put everything into perspective. But I quickly down spiraled after I had her, and suffered with this down spiral for 2 years before I got help. And it was only until that I was going to take my life that I realized I needed to do something. And my husband basically told me to call the doctor, or he was going to call the doctor. And long story short, I was prescribed Prozac,
right,
which helped me amazingly.
One of the things that's hard to fathom about Susie Favor Hamilton is how a highly disciplined, self-described perfect girl went from being a three-time Olympic runner to a high-priced escort in Las Vegas. Coming up, she tells me about how the mania from her bipolar disorder pushed her to further and further extremes, and how getting exposed may have been the impetus for finally getting control of her life. Well, it hasn't been easy, and Dr. Phil certainly didn't help. Telling her story is ultimately not only helping her move on, but she's also hoping to raise awareness and offer inspiration to others coping with mental illness. You're on Prozac. You're feeling better. And then you describe the escort work you get into as being the result of mania, or maybe it was the trigger for the mania.
Right. And after Prozac, I went off because I didn't like the waking. And then I went on a new drug called Zoloft. Mm. Zoloft helped to bring out the mania of the bipolar, which I didn't know I had. Otherwise, I would hope they never would have given me Zoloft knowing I was bipolar.
Had you had that kind of mania before?
I could get a little mania through my running. When I did extreme, incredible feats, I could get that mania. It didn't last long, though.
Yeah, and you talk about this high that you would get when you would see clients. And the word that keeps coming up over and over, and it's come up several times in this conversation, is power.
Incredible power.
Where did that power derive from?
I developed an alter ego named Kelly. And Kelly was powerful, bit of a badass, but very compassionate, very nice. easygoing. You could tell Kelly anything and it would not faze her. Any fantasy you wanted, no problem. We'll make that happen. Kelly's personality came from my best friend, Mary. She was strong, confident, bit of a badass. No guy was ever going to tell her what to do. Mary, obviously, but there's no way she would have been an escort.
Your job was to have guys tell you what to do, literally.
Yes. And then I had the power to fulfill it. And the better I fulfilled it, and the better their praise, the more power I felt I had. I remember being delusional during that time and seeing people in a different way. They looked different than what they look like now. And the reason I know that is because I've Googled a couple of the names and I'm like, oh my God, that person looks completely different.
That's interesting. That's something I was wondering about actually reading your book, because in your book you talk about, inevitably, you talk about these guys as being handsome or striking or attractive.
Gorgeous. Yeah.
And I'm like, I just can't, I mean, just on a numbers game, I can't imagine all these guys are that good looking.
Right, because I slept with around 100 men, and every single one of them was incredibly good looking. Now, and again, like I said, looking back, that delusion state, that's what made me so good and get up in the rankings, because I never walked up to a door and when the client opened the door, decided to turn around and say, no thanks, where other girls did that in that industry. I couldn't understand why women would do that in that industry. And personally, I'm not a shallow person, but that wouldn't have happened. But I did see them different than what they really look like. I guess I grabbed on to whatever was good in them.
Right.
And it magnified the experience.
I mean, this is great customer service. This is what I need, yes, in every aspect of my life. Somebody to grab onto what's good about me. Please.
Yeah.
You just mentioned the rankings. And I found this kind of sort of stunning and hilarious, but also kind of perfect for a competitive athlete. Escorts are ranked. And
yeah,
you prided yourself on your ranking.
I was ninth in the world. I was ninth in the world.
You get a trophy? Like, I mean, what does that mean?
You get paid more. It's just like, it is just bizarre, because the running world was exactly like that. You get ranked, you get paid more money.
And you get sponsored in the same exact way.
Yeah, I was so easy to put that running world I grew up, and put it right into escorting. Yet escorting, it was easy. It wasn't like running. You had to train, and you know, it was the same grind. Escorting, it was so easy, and I got rewarded so much better with, you know, diamonds and fur coats and Louis Vuittons and all this stuff that I was getting. In reality, it's just stuff. But at that state of mind, it was the best world, and thumbing through hundreds of dollars and buying whatever I wanted, which I did in excess.
Your marriage stays intact during this period, although it seems like kind of just barely. Mark, your husband, is aware of what you're doing and sort of gives his tacit approval, although it's clear that he's not happy. How did you view the relationship at that point, and why did you stay with him?
At that time, we had kind of gone our separate ways, and obviously Vegas is making me go my separate way even more.
Because you're living in Madison, Wisconsin full-time and then traveling to Vegas on weekends and whenever.
Right. And that period was 6 months from the threesome before I became the escort, just to kind of point that out. But he tried to get me out, but he also enabled at the same time. He couldn't get me out, so the enabling became, I'll cover for her. I don't want her reputation to be ruined. If this ever came out, she's done. I can't tell anybody, he felt. So that enabling part was there. In hindsight, he wished we had never done the threesome, because that set me off on a whole journey. And the Zoloft, I was misdiagnosed, you know, also caused that hypersexuality. I still question today, it's hard to understand, would I have done the threesome? And I guess there's a part of me that really thinks I would have, but was the drug the driving force to get me there? And I guess I'll never know that answer.
There's a huge jump that I think listeners may be trying to wrap their heads around. How you get from having a consensual threesome with an escort and your husband in Vegas to then taking it to the point of now I'm going to go off on my own and become an escort.
Admittedly, a very extreme step. And I completely understand why the viewers
I get it. Like not. I've been tempted to go that route myself.
Oh, many, you know, doing this interview, people have been, oh, I've done that. What's the big deal? Or right. How could, there's such extremes from it. Personally, I didn't see it as anything bad. Again, Mark and I being sexual human beings and wanting to explore, we had always talked about this. But there is this taboo with it in our society.
You mean with threesomes, with escorting.
Right. But I also, when I went into escorting, I sold Mark on the idea that it would be very discreet and there would be a low risk of safety because all these guys had a background check. And before I became an escort, I was randomly picking up guys at bars. And in hindsight, that was way more dangerous.
You mean in Vegas? You would go to Vegas and do this?
Right. Because Mark and I also at that time agreed, let's do a little open relationship for a while. Susie can have her sexual exploration because I've been her only partner. So I'm willing to give her that freedom to try it out. And he saw how happy I was. And here I'd been depressed so long. He saw, but he didn't put two and two that the Zoloft just started to give me this high.
Right.
So it was an interesting time. I did, picking up men at bars. And then there was this thought, I want to get something out of this now. This isn't enough. I also hired a male gigolo, and he was the one who said, sex for money? Oh my God, this is awesome. It's the best job in the world. That was a light bulb moment for me.
One of the things that really strikes me about your recounting of this period in your life is how happy you seem. I mean, you create this alter ego
go,
and it seems so joyous because you're able to be this other person. Did it feel joyous, and does it feel joyous to you now looking back on it?
I was so happy. I'd never been that happy in my life because the high I was feeling, and it was an extended high. I know I had to get caught in order to save my life, because the one problem with escorting and being bipolar is you don't have a ceiling to what you're going to do. You'll just continue to take more and more risks. So for me, doing crazy stuff was a better high. I had to have more. I started doing drugs because now the drugs were, oh my God, I was doing tons of ecstasy and it was unbelievable.
I know.
Oh my God. Have you tried it?
God, yes.
And it's just, have you stopped or do you still do it?
If I could get it, if I had an easy way to get it, I would be doing it probably, once a month or something.
I know. That's the problem. It is so intoxicating that, I'm not trying to justify the drug. I haven't done the drug since Vegas, but they're finding that it's good in certain patients with depression. Not that they do it every day.
Right, I know. I've actually been reading studies about it and PTSD as well. They're treating with it.
Yes. So I loved that drug, but I remember also sneaking more when the client wasn't looking. So I had this need to have more and more. So I never had that limit to know when to stop. And if you're with the wrong client, they don't give a shit about you. They care about, they want to feel good.
Did you care about them?
In some cases, yes. I wanted to, the clients that I really liked, I wanted to, in some ways they were like boyfriends to me. Because we just clicked and it was so much fun. I'm like, I'm getting paid $12,000 or whatever to do this. So I think a part of me definitely a part of me broke the escorting rule. You don't get too close to the client.
Is that why you were so good?
Yes.
Were you ever in physical danger? I mean, you say that you needed to get caught to save your life. What would have happened? Would it just been like sort of harder drugs and more extreme situations, and then eventually something would break?
Yeah. So I was bound to get caught, even though I never wanted to. The behavior was going to get, I was going to get caught. But I, again, in thinking back in hindsight, I had rejected a client twice because I'm living a double life. I'm back in Wisconsin being the housewife and the mother, which was so difficult, and I'm depressed that I couldn't get to Vegas. So this particular client thought for sure I was rejecting him. I didn't like him. And so he was the one who told the smoking gun about me. And, you know, he could have done something to hurt me rather than hurt me by ruining my life, meaning he could have easily had me killed, hitman. I mean, there's crazy things in Vegas that go on. So I think his damage to really hurt me was, let's ruin her life because she's not making me happy.
So the story breaks.
I get caught
and
by this tabloid, and my life is over. I'm done. Might as well just be an escort because everybody thinks I'm a slut and a whore anyways.
Was some part of you like, well, then fuck it, that's what I'm going to do then?
There was definitely a part of me that was like, okay, I'll charge $2,000 an hour.
Right.
And guess this is my life.
So why didn't you?
Because I had people around me when it came out that knew something was terribly wrong, that something is wrong with her mind. When I was outed, the ones around me who loved me the most were there and were determined to get me help. And Mark was the driving one. He saw me slipping, and he focused on my disease and getting me the right doctors, getting the best doctors, not just a doctor. He went to get the best doctors, and he didn't focus on my behavior.
But why did he wait until you'd been caught to take those steps?
So basically, he tried to pull me out, and I wasn't telling him everything I was doing, because in my mind, it was normal. So, and there was a part of me in the back of my mind that if I did tell him, he's not going to let me go back to Vegas. Mm. And I can't let that happen because that's when I'm at my happiest. When I'm manic, I was, you know, with Rock and Roll and Disney, who I was working with, it's ironic because they loved me when I was manic. All these people loved me in the manic mode.
Do you love you now that you're not in that mode?
It's harder. I mean, you like yourself. You should love yourself. You should take care of yourself.
I know we all should.
Yes.
But a lot of times I know I don't.
Exactly. And there's those days that they're just difficult because you remember how you're so high and you want that. But I assume this is what life and most people are at least my husband says, this is more reality. People aren't sky high happy like you were every day in Vegas. You're having to learn a whole new way of life. And because of my meds, they've made me content. They've made me settled. But I want that so desperately. I want to feel that high, especially when I'm at my lows.
The biggest question on everybody's mind as they watch this interview, as they read the book, is how could a mother, a wife, a world-class athlete, an Olympian, end up advertising herself as a high-class call girl on the internet, hooking up with men in Vegas, LA, Chicago? How did that happen?
When you did get out of it or were forced out of it, well, you embraced it. You embraced your story and you wrote this book, and you're promoting the book and speaking very candidly about it. I was watching you on Dr. Phil. And
oh, my God. Don't watch that.
Well, I did. And there was this.
I wasn't happy with that show.
I could tell. And I wanted to talk to you about it.
I didn't watch it, by the way.
Because you go on Dr. Phil, you kind of know what you're going to get. I mean,
I didn't. And I didn't want to go on that. And they kept telling me, the producer, Dr. Phil is a big fan of yours. He tells that to everybody.
Of course he does.
I don't have any good words to say.
Well, because there was a lot of condemnation in it.
Yeah. I'm like, don't you understand bipolar? You're supposed to be a doctor.
Right.
It's interesting because before I did that show, when I'm in the green room, the woman comes in and she says, oh, sign all these papers, please. Basically, we have hidden cameras in this room, so we might be filming you. Mm. You can't, whatever we say, we have full control over. There were a couple things that we changed right away on the contract because the publisher wanted me to do this. They want to make money on the book. So that's
those
a whole other story.
Assholes wanting to make their money
back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm furious at
but
that.
But the woman comes in and tells us, by the way, many people leave this show feeling very angry and very upset at Dr. Phil. I just want you to know ahead of time that it always turns out and they're happy at the end once they see the final product. Why didn't that click right then and there to get out of there? We're like, oh, well, they're telling us it's going to end really nice. It's going to end in a good way. That show put me on a spiral downward.
Really?
Yes.
And then so how do you cope with that now?
I was on a spiral for a week and I kept thinking, this is just awful. Here this guy is trying to help, yet he's portraying me completely different than I am and my husband. And oh my God, his last question was just gross. I mean, he says, by the way, Mark, what do you think when these men are grunting and sweating on top of your wife? I'm like, you've got to be kidding. Again, you're a doctor. And this is what you say?
If you didn't have a daughter and a husband, I'm not even phrasing it correctly now. But I think I know what you're getting.
There's a sense. Just kind of say it.
Yeah, well, I can't quite figure out how to say it. There's a sense of your sexuality that I feel like, you know, the idea that you have to put it under control and that I guess I feel like there's a sense of resentment sort of running under the book that this is something that needs to be controlled. And I wonder if, A, if I'm reading that correctly or B, if you think that's accurate.
Well, being under, like, why do I have to be under control, right? Is that kind of why?
I guess, or this sense of female sexuality in particular as being something that needs to be tamed.
I don't think, like, for me, it has to be tamed. It has to. I have to take this drug to take away the hypersexuality because the risky behavior will cause so much damage to the people around me, to myself. If I wasn't bipolar, would I be doing this? I wouldn't have gotten into it if I wasn't bipolar, so I never would have experienced this world. But after experiencing this world, I have my preconceived notions were the woman on the corner picking up men. And, you know, now after being in this different world, I look at it in such a different light, meaning if women want to do this, it's their body, they have that choice. I can't, as much as I got the high and the thrill, I can't go there.
All right. Well, Susie Favor Hamilton, we end each episode with something called The Amazing Five, where I will ask you for recommendations in five different categories. Just one recommendation will do. So let's start with food. Any food that you would recommend to our listeners?
Well, I would recommend M&M's because they make me happy and they give
peanut
me a sugar
or
high.
Plain?
Plain.
Okay. That's just classic straight up M&M.
Yes.
Do you have a favorite color?
My favorite color would be green. I've always liked the color green because it was my birthstone for August.
A book.
I have two. The Unquiet Mind, which my husband read right while I was being diagnosed as bipolar. Totally shed light on my illness. And my favorite book of all time, The Giving Tree.
Oh, I love The Giving Tree.
Oh my God, that book is just amazing.
Movie.
Star Wars. The whole thing.
Music.
That is so hard because who do you like?
I return to this periodically, the original Broadway cast recording of Les Misérables.
Oh, that's really good. When I was in high school, it was the B-52s.
Mm-hmm. Any particular album?
Rock Lobster.
Is that the name of the, is Rock Lobster the name of the album? It is, right?
I believe so.
I think it's actually just the B-52s. The B-52s, I think, is the album with Rock. Yeah, I think it's.
With Rock Lobster.
Yeah, I think. But you know, I'm not. What do I know?
I like classical a lot, too.
Oh, do you have a favorite classical composer?
Paul Cardell.
Who's that?
That's his last name. Oh, just like Google him. He's got some great inspirational music.
Is he a living?
Yes.
How do you spell his last name?
It's Cardel, I believe.
Cardell, just
now
like
I have
it sounds.
To go on my playlist to check.
Our listeners will look it up.
Cardall. Yeah.
Got it. Miscellaneous. Anything from your life you would recommend?
Get out and, oh my God, this is the best. Do it by yourself. Hike the Grand Canyon. And it's easy to book it if you're doing a solo person. You don't need a year in advance. I did it a week in advance. Hike the Grand Canyon to the bottom. There's a little cabin that you stay in with like six other women. And take a bath in the stream. Get the $50 steak dinner at the bottom. And you're in a little cabin. And then hike back up with a light on your head at 5 in the morning. And that is a really good high.
That was
would
the
you
most,
do that?
Oh my God, I would love to. I mean, I don't know that the women would want me there, but
they do have a cabin for men.
I figured.
Yes, so you would. Still
I was doing
be
one of my
welcomed.
Patented jokes.
Oh yeah, that because you're telling the truth and.
Is the most specific, and I think that might be my favorite answer to miscellaneous we've gotten so far. That was
really
awesome.
That's awesome.
You just shot to the top of the rankings. Susie Faber-Hamilton.
Yay! Thank you.
Thank you so much.
But do it.
For your
promise me you'll do it.
I would love to do it. In fact, I think I'm
but
gonna
you
be
can
able,
do it.
That I can do it?
You can do it.
I know I can.
Okay.
Susie Faber-Hamilton, thank you so much for being on the show. Thank you for writing the book. And thank you for being amazing.
Well, thank you. And thanks for reading my book. I really appreciate it. Because
I really enjoyed it.
Because Dr. Phil did not.
Of course he
so
didn't.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. How to Be Amazing is brought to you by PRX. Like How to Be Amazing on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @HTBA_show. And check out our website at howtobeamazingshow.com. If you like what you've heard, please write us a nice review on iTunes. Say how handsome I sound. How to Be Amazing is produced by Jennifer Brennan and Mary Shimkin. It's recorded at Argo Studio, New York City. Today's show is mixed and edited by Jason Saldana with music composed by Chad Crouch. Post-production work was also done by Barry O'Halloran. I am, as always, Michael Ian Black.